Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's December 21st, 2014, and welcome to episode 90 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, this is one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and uncollecting. With me today are Earl Evans is returning. How are you, Earl?
Hey there, Paul. I'm doing good. How are you, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. It's still increasingly cold, and I'm getting more buried increasingly in old stuff, but we'll talk about that.
Well, you can take solace in the fact that as of 6 p.m. Eastern, we've officially hit the winter solstice. So from there forward, the days just get longer, my friend.
Yes, and hopefully the stacks get smaller as well. And joining us from Australia is Mike Mulhern. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Quite the opposite here. Very warm, humid, muggy, and wishing it was just a touch colder.
Yeah, if we could just meet somewhere in the middle. So this is episode 90, and we've now completed all of the episodes that were numbered in the 80s, where we were covering all of the years that were in the 80s. As of 1990, from where we sit in 2014, it seems a bit like the interest in the retro computing period has passed. So we are not going to cover, you know, the 90s in the episodes in the 90s, but in 3 years or so, when we get to episode 170, we may go back.
Swing back around.
Yes. Anyone want to complain about the 90s?
Oh, no, I've got too much to complain about the 90s. I still haven't forgiven the 90s for actually existing. So, no, there was nothing to me exciting happening in the 90s computer-wise.
I'm still angry at the 90s for destroying the bulletin board systems with this newfangled internet thing.
It'll never catch on.
How dare they?
It is true. I felt like that was instant. I mean, you know, there were bulletin boards, and then 7 months later or something, they were all gone.
Then there weren't. I know. It did happen very fast.
Oh, well. So, given that we are no longer doing a year-by-year thing, we need a host topic. And today's host topic is going to be, since it is the holiday season, and, you know, everyone is on every podcast is talking about what do you get people, what should you add to your collection in this holiday time? Our topic today will be downsizing.
Oh, good. How to get rid of all that stuff.
That's right.
Re-gifting.
Not everybody, of course, will be at this point, but I think it's probably something that all of us will at some point be considering. You know, you've got the collecting bug. You used to have spare room and money, and now you don't. And, you know, your family's getting after you. And what do you do? How do you choose what to get rid of? Or how do you get rid of it? That sort of thing. I think I'm sort of curious just to brainstorm on this a little bit, because I think everybody is going to, everyone who sort of gets into this either rescuing or collecting mindset will wind up at some point with more stuff than space. So anyone want to start on thoughts on this?
I totally agree. I basically started off just collecting early Macintosh computers and then sort of like slipped into buying Macs that I coveted as a younger person and could never afford, and now they was like, you know, popping up all over the place and getting too many. And then I still had my original Apple II from 1984 and started collecting books and software and peripherals, and it was just getting out of control. So I basically just had to bite the bullet, and I decided that I was just going to concentrate on the early Macs, as in the 128, the 512K. They're the ones that I'm currently working towards, and then just concentrating on my Apple II and other non-Apple computers of the same era, which I've been managing to collect, and at the same time donate, sell some of my newer machines that really were just taking up space. And now I'm starting to look at my library. I've come to the unfortunate conclusion that having 250 linear feet of shelving for books might just be considered a tad large. So starting to have a look in there about what books I don't really need to be keeping, and start getting those out of the 8-bit bunker. So it's a difficult, heart-rending decision at times to what to keep, what to get rid of, and you just have to do it at some stage, I think.
And Earl, what's your experience with this? I think you periodically up and downsize, right?
A little bit. I think Michael has it pegged in terms of a downsizing strategy to look at your favorites, look at your priorities, and then try to focus on those and eventually whittle down the artifacts that you have in your collection that don't fall into those categories. And I also completely agree that it is a tough decision, because those of us growing up with computing in the 70s and 80s, and maybe I have even a more diverse sort of experience in this, because I worked in computer retail, so I got to touch so many of these different computers back in the day and develop a fondness for their particular niche or capabilities or that sort of thing. So it's just hard to get rid of anything. So I am making some of those hard decisions at the moment as I try to reclaim some of my space. I'm wondering whether or not the problem that we're looking at is unique to the first generation of collectors. Well, let me take that back. Maybe not the first generation. I think the first generation of collectors, some of the folks that I've spoken with that collected big iron things like digital equipment and IBM computers and that sort of thing, that took a lot of wherewithal, you know, to power those big beasts. And I don't know if they were going to get rid of them. I think maybe they would have already. But then there was the fallout of the 80s, where when I got into vintage computing in 2000, and I picked up that VIC-20, which was my gateway drug, then everybody that I knew that understood I was interested in retro computers had something in their attic or basement that they wanted to give me. And so it was cheap. It was free in a lot of cases. So the collection just grew unexpectedly fast. And all of a sudden, I've got tons of stuff. I mean, even my pet 2001, somebody gave to me. That wouldn't happen today, I don't think. I think that'd be pretty rare for somebody to give you a fully functional Commodore PET. And so now, in the fallout of that, I think a lot of the second generation of collectors, the micro collectors, are kind of sitting around and going, wow, I just got a house full of stuff. What am I going to do? I've seen YouTubes of collections that are way more out of control than my own. And so I think it is that generation that's going to grapple with this. I don't know that going forward we're going to have that much of a problem, because if you look at eBay prices and the scarcity of finding things at the local Goodwill or car boot sales or things like that, I don't think people's collections are going to be able to expand as rapidly without some discretionary income.
Yeah, although I think that's one of the things that has helped, you know, sort of people who grew up with these computers get such huge collections is basically that now they're adults, you know, and they're working, and you know, they have, you know, it's maybe a little expensive for what it is, but you know, it's not going to matter much. So yeah, I don't know. I know that for me, I've kind of had this characteristic throughout my life. You know, I remember as a kid, I would, you know, there'd be like I'd have a radio that would break or something, and I would keep it because I thought, well, I'll fix it someday. And and went off to college and came back, and, you know, my mother kept saying, we just get rid of some of the stuff in the basement. And I keep looking at the thing and thinking, well, I could fix it someday. But, I think that kind of attitude certainly contributed to the stuff I have. And it's not so much that I could fix everything or whatever, but I have a lot of things here that would be neat to play with. But if I actually sat and thought about, you know, spending a week with each one of these things, you know, that's years that went by. And, you know, so there's also a certain amount of kind of just deciding, you know, I'm never going to do this justice. There's no point in my sitting on something that maybe somebody else really wants to use.
Ah, so in other words, maybe we could spread the wealth, and it would be interesting if the hobby grew and each person had maybe a more narrow collection in terms of which computer models they were focusing on, but had a deeper collection and could afford to buy some of the cool new gadgets that come out for these things, like the disk drive emulators and the books, like Michael was saying. I have nowhere near 200. What would be the measurement of that book feet?
I was just down there yesterday, getting some Christmas decorations out, and I just was standing there looking at it and going, well, I've got 6 6-foot bookcases and I think 9 3-foot bookcases in height. And that's just, there's so many books there now. I've got histories and military books and computing books and craft and everything. And, it's sort of like, a book comes by my way, I can't get rid of it. Now, I'm slightly less hold on with paperback novels, but even when I went in, around the corner to get the Christmas decorations, there's a whole series of bookcases with paperback science fiction novels from the 70s and the 80s. And I find it so hard to even contemplate parting with those, because I might be turning into the archetypal grumpy old man, but I seem to feel that fiction was better back then. You didn't buy a book that was 2-3 inches thick. You bought a book and you weren't expecting it to turn into a 10-part series. There was a good story. Computer books were totally different back in the 80s, and I just sort of going through them and sort of thinking, well, I'm going to have to sort of like pick topics. And then I was when I was pulling out the Christmas decorations, I came across 2 3-inch reel-to-reel tape recorders, an old Grundig and a National. And I'm going, I don't even remember who I got these from, but who do I know that would be interested in 3-inch reel-to-reel tape recorders that I could donate them onto? It's not just the retro computers that are in my life. It's all the other retro bits and pieces that come along with it.
And I think that's true. I think collecting is a bug. So I agree that you have to have some means to prioritize both what class of things that you'll collect and also within those classes, what sort of things are interesting to you. I started out where I just wanted to have Commodore computers, but as time went on and other things came into the collection, it fell into a couple different categories. One were the computers that I had played with, and so it was fun to see them again. And in other cases, it was computers that I'd only seen from afar, and I thought, well, this is great. Now's my chance to actually get some mileage with this. I knew about it back then, but I never played with it. This is one of the reasons why it's so hard to get rid of this stuff. It's just, but I agree with you, Paul. We're never going to be able to do it justice, even if you took one out every week. You know, how right. long would it take to rotate through the collection or fix up the things that need fixing? But I have a question for you on this. When you go to downsize, what are the strategies for parting with some of these things? eBay seems, I think there's pluses and minuses with eBay, I feel. The pluses being that you've got such a wide audience, but the minuses being that the fees have become much higher these days. And also, you've got to pack this stuff for shipment, and that's not trivial. For both of you guys, what has your experience been in that realm when you've been parting with things in your collection? How do you do it?
Yeah, I have used eBay so far, and I sort of agree with the pluses and minuses. The fees and actually just shipping generally are pretty expensive. I didn't really use eBay for this prior, so I don't remember a day when the fees were less. But it is kind of eye opening when you switch from buyer to seller and realize that, you know, so much of what you paid for what you got went to the shipping company and to eBay and PayPal. It's not easy to make a whole lot of money at it. And you know, I've also been sort of wrestling with, you know, the question of should I feel guilty about, you know, selling this for money? But I rationalize this by saying that, you know, well, this is subsidizing what I keep. But yeah, I mean, with Craigslist or other sort of local things, the only problem is just that there has to be somebody around who wants it. And so if you're in a big enough area, then that might work. Somebody could just come get it, and you know, you don't have to worry about packing it up and or you know, other shenanigans that can happen on eBay with sellers, buyers and sellers that are far apart. But yeah, I haven't tried anything myself for getting rid of things, apart from in a couple of cases just handing them off, mainly just through eBay. And I've actually had pretty good luck with. I haven't had any real problems with eBay, apart from the fact that just you don't get all that much of the amount that the buyer spends.
Well, I don't want to turn it into a bash session on eBay, but I'll just tell you one little case study experience that happened to me. I was selling a Tandy microcolor computer, the MC10. And I thought, this is small, self-contained. I got it in basically brand new condition, and it's still that way. So this would be a fairly good candidate. They don't go for very much, but I didn't need it. Wasn't something I was interested in keeping. So I put it on eBay, and immediately a person from Italy bought it. And I thought, how is this possible? Because I had said, we'll ship only to United States addresses. I'd check that little box on eBay. The thing I didn't know, and people should be careful about this, is that eBay switched the area of the site where you select regions that you're not going to sell to. And I thought that I had already deselected those. And when I went through listing this one particular item, I didn't see those. And I thought, well, okay, good. eBay remembered. It did not. And so the person who bought my computer actually bought it off the Italian eBay. I don't remember what that domain is, but, and so that was a little bit of confusion trying to figure out, okay, now I've got to readjust the shipping price for international shipping, and it needs customs paperwork filled out. And by the time we got this all done, it was a real boondoggle. And that particular problem probably won't happen to me again, because now I know how to solve that. But I don't know what other problems or confusions or logistical issues lay in wait. And that's the thing that's put me off from using that mechanism to downsize more of my collection, I guess I'd say. It just, you know, there's unknowns, and
right.
And it's a little scary, and I don't have a ton of time.
I've also found it is actually it takes a tremendous amount of time, so much more time than you think, to list things on eBay. I mean, going through and taking pictures of everything and you know, filling in the text and weighing it all, and you know, it's not, despite the ease with which I feel like I sometimes mock listings, you know, it's hard to actually get them listed up there.
I agree.
Yeah, until you've actually spent the time writing up the description and putting the information in, precisely for the reason, because, you know, you're, even if just quietly disparaging to yourself about other people's listings where they don't say anything about it, there's no information, and sometimes they just say, you know, see picture. And now I want to know a bit more about it, which might be the problem of being a collector. I want to know about the item, not just the item. It's where it was used. But the other problem I find with eBay is that I have picked up personally a lot of my computers, and I know how difficult it would be to actually pack them for travel, let alone international travel. And when I was at university, I used to spend time at the, I suppose, downstairs in the warehouse where my father worked, packaging stuff up and sending it. And I know what's involved in packing things up properly. And that's quite a bit of time and effort to get that done. But sometimes you receive stuff that's just been thrown into a satchel, and they trust to the gods that it arrives in one piece, or they don't even bother. That's I've posted it, you've paid for it, not my problem anymore. But to me, I'd like to hand my stuff over to someone I know who's going to want it, to use it, or needs it. Maybe I've got too much attachment to my stuff. I feel that if I put it up on eBay, it could go to just anybody, which that's a plus, I suppose, as well. There's all these anybodies out there who could buy it, but I have too much attachment, I suppose, to my stuff, and maybe that's my problem.
Well, if that's your problem, then I feel like that's probably all of our problems. I don't think you're alone. We could start a support group. But that's true. Packaging these things, if you want them to arrive in roughly the same condition that you shipped them, is a non-trivial exercise also. And I always try to carefully pack because, like you, Michael, I've had things that have arrived where obviously no care was paid to how they were packaged. And in one case, I had a really nice Apple IIe computer that was cracked when it arrived because the person just basically threw it in a box. Something you mentioned a little earlier, Paul, I wouldn't feel any kind of guilt or oddness about selling the computers for money, even if you received them for free. Because again, I think that enough of our collections will deteriorate over time that, you know, the phenomenon where you have a computer that works one day and then the next day, magically, a cosmic ray or something, now you don't have a computer that works anymore. So you've got a certain amount of attrition that happens there. Plus the fact all the other things that we buy in life tend to depreciate. You drive the car off the lot and you lose X thousands of dollars or whatever. So with computers, the fact that they may have appreciated from the point that they were given to you, I think is just maybe one of life's little ways of balancing things out.
Okay. Yeah, I will. I'll take that to heart. But there is a certain obsessional sort of flavor to this that has, I think, wound up having me spend more than I should have. So, I do think the idea of subsidizing what I keep is probably a nice way to think of it.
Right. You're funding the Museum of Paul. That's, I totally support that.
Okay. Michael, did you have any other thing you wanted to add on this?
No, I think I'll just have to go downstairs over the Christmas break and just sort of start pulling a few things out and getting them up on eBay. I know it's going to hurt, but I think I'm just going to have to get in there and do it.
Okay, so with the downsizing topic out of the way, happy holidays.
Was our counter-programming, right?
Right,
everybody
exactly.
Else was doing the Christmas specials. We're doing the get rid of that stuff special. So hope that was fun for everyone.
Very Grinchian. but we can move on to items of interest and news. And Michael, actually, I'll let you take the first one here.
Okay. Well, that would be the Wizard of Oz. Steve Wozniak is finally going to become an Australian permanent resident. That's the next step along the way to becoming a full citizen. Obviously, he still has speaking commitments and lots of travel, so he wouldn't be qualifying for full Australian citizenship. But that's something that's probably coming down the track. So early in October, we announced how he was taking up an adjunct professor position at the University of Technology here in Sydney. And they've looking at buying a house, becoming a permanent resident. So his son's already married an Aussie, so he's got ties down here. So looking forward to the Woz coming to the great land down under.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I think, you know, that maybe you'll see him like in the supermarket or something, right?
I have to find out where, without becoming stalking or anything like that. But perhaps we can flick him an invite to the Oz K Fest in March next year. You never know.
That would be excellent. And actually, the other thing about him is that no stalking is required. Just follow his Twitter feed. He posts everywhere he goes.
I've got him on my Twitter feed. And if you don't pay attention, then sometimes he just turns up in the strangest of places.
I will just briefly mention this. So yet another Apple One has come and gone, one was sold. And this one sold for only $365,000, which is a little bit interesting because that's a big dip from the one that was previous to that, which I think it was just about $1 million.
Look, they're just about to become totally worthless. So if any listeners out there have an Apple One, just send it to me. I'll just give it a good home on a shelf. Just look after it. There's no value. They're plummeting.
Yeah.
Next one, you're going to have to pay someone to take it.
Right. Get out while you can.
That's right. Yeah, just give it away while it's worth nothing before it becomes a liability.
What I think was interesting about this one, and actually, in a way, that makes it even more surprising, I think, that it didn't go higher. But there was a book maybe, I don't know, 1 or 2 years ago that Bob Luther wrote that was about basically, you know, getting a hold of an Apple One in I think it was like a police auction, you know, storage space auction or something, and then sort of tracking down the history of it and finding that it was maybe one of the only ones that was sold directly from Apple. And then he wrote this book called The First Apple about it. And, you know, so that was sort of a big deal in these circles. It's pretty interesting. I actually honestly haven't finished it, but it's interesting that this is that Apple One that was being written about in that book, and still it somehow that was some kind of a disadvantage for it.
Yeah, frankly, I don't understand it. I wonder if the prices paid for the other ones were just irrational exuberance, or and this maybe isn't an or but an and, that as the life and passing of Steve Jobs starts to fade a little bit in people's consciousness, as time does that, I wonder if some of that is taking a little bit of sparkle off of the Apple One prices too. So it's just hard to know why something. I mean, you'd think this particular Apple One would have sold for more than some of the others sold for. So I don't get it.
Yeah,
it has a little bit more cachet about it than some of the other ones, but really, I suppose that there must be a limit to the number of people who are willing to put out nearly over $700,000 for an Apple One computer. There's lots of people with the money, but you've got to find the people with the money and the desire. Maybe we've reached saturation point on massive Apple One prices.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I sort of feel like we're in kind of a run of Apple One sales. I mean, you know, like I mentioned it as yet another Apple One just because, you know, this is like the fourth or fifth or something that's, you know, in kind of recent memory. And I don't think maybe they just weren't publicized as much, or maybe I wasn't paying attention, but I don't remember them being a thing much before that. So, I mean, they were rare and interesting, but they didn't get the same kind of publicity. And, you know, as soon as they start selling for this huge amount, then everybody who has one decides, all right, I've had this as long as I need it. So if I had that to downsize, I suppose probably I could use that just to buy a bigger space.
And then you wouldn't have to downsize anymore.
Exactly.
So, like, what you mean walking into your collection and saying, I'm sorry, but one of you has got to go.
That sounds very bleak. Earl, maybe you can do the next one.
Well, you know, to continue in our Grinch-like approach to this Christmas show, we've got Dr. Dobbs closing down after all of these years. I won't say too much about it, only that they said revenue was the key reason, and they're not going to close down their website. They're going to leave it up as a living archive, but no new content will be published henceforth. So as we were musing before the show, the days of calisthenics and orthodontia are over for Dr. Dobbs. And, you know, farewell and rest in peace, because, wow, what a piece of computing history, all the way back to the early articles that kicked them off on Tiny Basic and creating your own computer language, to being such a valuable resource for computer languages at all, I think. Anyway, we salute you, Dr. Dobbs. Thanks for the memories.
I sort of vaguely remember, I think I maybe started reading a little bit of it, you know, right in the late 80s, probably, or early 90s. I came across a couple of them, and, you know, it seemed interesting. Although even then, I think it was a little bit hard to be broad, you know, because the breadth of computing was already so wide. But I always really liked the name. It started out, Dr. Dobbs' Journal of Computer Calisthenics and Orthodontia, Running Late Without Overbite.
Techies.
Yeah, I enjoyed reading it in the early days, but it was one of those things which I stopped following. It just, as we've said, there was just too broad a subject of programming, and I kind of just sort of faded away from it. And then in recent times, I suppose, became reaware of it, and now at least there's no new stuff to catch up on. It's just all the old stuff.
Yeah, I actually sometimes feel like that. This took a complete tangent, but about television programs, like, I almost don't want to start watching them until I know that they're ended. You know, like they're canceled, so that I know there's a finite amount.
Well, and that they ended without a cliffhanger, because a couple of the shows that I watched in real time, the series got canceled, but they canceled on a cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
Really? You're really going to do that to your viewers? So, yeah, these days I feel more comfortable. Like, we binge-watched Chuck on Netflix, and it's because I knew it had an actual ending. Anyway, that was a tangent, wasn't it? But I just had to get out there. Network, stop doing that.
Although Twin Peaks actually is going to pick up after its cliffhanger 25 years later.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Let's see. Okay. More in the publishing world. Michael, you had something?
Yes, assembly lines. This is something which I didn't follow too regularly in the Softalk magazine, mainly because I wasn't subscribing to Softalk, and it was basically just, oh, look, there's a Softalk I haven't read, and I just pick it up and flip through it. But there was a column in there, Roger Wagner's assembly lines articles, have now been all collected together into what they call the complete book. It's the Beginner's Guide to 6502 Programming. So predominantly aimed at Apple II assembly programmers, but 6502, it's everywhere in our retro machine, so possibly there's going to be much of this is going to be relevant to all machines, just graphics and a few other bits and pieces that are going to be Apple specific. But if you can pick up the book, it's currently on a 40% special. So consider this your Christmas hint from the Retro Computing Roundtable, or at least from Uncle Michael.
Right.
No, nice. I've gone and hit on the buy link, so I'm waiting for mine to arrive. So hardcover, 456 pages of 6502 goodness.
Yeah, just to fill in a little bit of the detail on this, so this assembly lines was a column Roger Wagner wrote in Softalk regularly for a long time, and after a little while, Softalk Publishing just collected them into a book. He did a little bit of editing with typos and things, but it was generally, you know, there was assembly lines, the book. But that actually didn't cover all of the columns that were in Softalk. It was basically just all of the columns that were, you know, sort of done by the time the book came out. And then he continued to write the columns, and then Softalk folded. And there's always some talk of kind of like making a volume two or whatever, but, so I think a lot of work by Chris Torrance, who is listed as the editor on here, went into kind of collecting them all together, you know, working with Roger Wagner, you know, and working on editing them, adding a couple of things at the end. So even if you have the, you know, the assembly lines book from Softalk from the past, this is like twice as much.
Yep. Well, that's be why they've called this one the complete book. But yes, they've all, Chris has also done a lot of work, as you said, on not just the editing of it, but making sure that all the code elements are correct from the OCR that was done. So you can be fairly confident that all of the examples in there have the correct symbols, and you know, it's a looks to be a superb publication. And as I said, I'm waiting with much eagerness for this one to arrive. I'm hoping that it also comes out as a e-book later on, but I'll get it as an e-book if it does come out. But I'm kind of a hard copy kind of guy, so I'm more happy that it's available as a book. There we are. I'm just gone and added another book to my library, haven't I?
Yes. Okay, let's see. I was going to mention, so I don't really know that much about this project, but I will still mention it anyway, because there's an announcement of the Carte Blanche 2 card for the Apple II is sort of getting close to coming out. And so I think it's mainly what I'm interested, I wanted to just sort of talk about what it is a little bit, to the extent that I understand it, but it's a FPGA card. So as I understand the way this works, it is kind of like, and that's why it's, I think, called Carte Blanche, that it's sort of like a blank slate in a way, you know, like it's a card you can put in the Apple II and you can program the gate array to be whatever card you want. And that sounds really cool to me. There was a run of these some years ago. It was a pretty small run, and they ran out fairly quickly. And this, they're somewhere along the state in the stage of producing more in a sort of second run. And I'm quite curious about them. But even just, you know, not in the Apple specific and Carte Blanche specific world, I think it's kind of a neat idea. You know, rather than having emulating an entire, you know, Amiga or whatever on an FPGA. The idea that you could just sort of have a chameleon card or something, you know, what a shape-shifting card, you can just put it in and, you know, say, today you are going to be a modem or, you know, a RAM card or something. That's just really cool.
I agree. I would like to play some more with FPGAs when I get some time. There are some lower-cost starter kits that you can get. One of them, I think, is the DE0 Nano kit, and there's a couple others that I've seen people play with. The notion that you can just create your own logic gates out of thin air seems fun, and especially if you put it in an Apple II, then you've got a combination of a retro appliance and learning some things about newer circuit design techniques. So, neato. Any idea what this will cost?
Nope. No, I remember thinking people might know. I just didn't look, but my recollection was that the first runs were fairly. I thought of them as fairly expensive, you know. So it's a bit of a commitment. But I think FPGA just in general, you know, is an expensive thing. Anyway, when it's actually out, I'm sure that I will do some soul and bank searching. Let's see. Okay, maybe just to get a little ways away from Apple, Michael, you had a thing you wanted to mention here in PC Magazine?
Yes, there was an article in PC Mag that I came across just the other day on PCs that paved the way for the Altair, as in the Altair 8800. So the first two entries in the column I missed, but I'll include them along in the show notes. So basically the series is looking at what is the concept of a personal computer, also talked about the creation of the 4004, the world's first microprocessor, all leading up to what a lot of people consider to be the first personal computer, the Altair. So in the latest column on December 17, they're talking about the Kenback 1, so as a something that was leading up to it. So here's some good Christmas reading, I suppose, that doesn't require the purchase of a book or anything. So,
right.
But it's just I like the article about the birth of the the concept of the personal computer. How 40 years ago things were quite different as to what is computing. We're definitely not talking about on your desk computing, unless the desk is in the actual computer room. But
interesting. I was just thinking, you know, any time you mention the word first. In relation to anything in retro computing, there's an argument to be had, but
first is kind of a fuzzy concept in some cases.
Hey everybody, the new computers are here.
New computers? Who, may I ask, authorized new computers?
Yeah, who?
You did.
Who did? I did. IBM. Of course I did.
The new IBM Personal System 2. The next generation in personal computing. New computers, new printers, and software. And IBM's new graphics put 256 colors on a screen at once, so our work will be bolder and brighter.
If it'll make him brighter, count me in.
Personal System 2 is faster. Oh, and it has incredible power.
Someone say, power?
It's a miracle. He's following instructions.
Hey, we were made for each other.
Is it easy to use?
Even you could use it.
Can we tie it all together?
Ooh, Personal System 2 has excellent connectivity.
So we can talk to each other?
Only if we have to.
It's just what we need. Who's responsible for this?
Well, I. IBM.
Introducing the new Personal System 2 family from IBM.
Okay, so now it is time for the host retro computing gift idea. And so I have picked something that I think it's a little bit weird as a gift idea, but the game IO Silver has just been released for iOS devices, and I think it might be available for Android as well. I should have looked that up. But so it's a game that was released by Beagle Brothers back in, you know, the 80s, and it was very popular. You know, it was on the Apple II, and it was very popular, and I remember playing it and liking it. It's a kind of a puzzle game, you know, but puzzle arcade, it's a nice kind of mix. And so Randy Brandt, who was part of Beagle Brothers at the back then, has teamed up with somebody to sort of make a new version. So this is it's a iOS version of the game. I've played it on my iPhone, and as I say, it may be available for Android as well. It's free to play. If you pay $1.99, you can get the 1984 Retro Pack, which actually lets you play with the original Apple II graphics. And there's another thing you can get that, you know, adds some sort of functionality. But I think it's very cool. If anyone, it's not expensive. So, you know, an iTunes gift card to somebody or yourself, it's a nice thing, and it's, faithful. So,
very cool. I think it's neat too that the Beagle Brothers original folks had some involvement in this game. That's great.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to finding more time to play it. But okay, and you know, so while we're considering buying things, we can now turn our attention to what people are selling on eBay. So Earl, maybe you can start.
Well, after hardly dissing the 90s. I picked an eBay pick from the 90s, a IBM PS2 Model 70. This has particular nostalgic value for me because I just absolutely begged my boss for one when these things came out. It was IBM's their way of getting into the 386 game after Compaq beat them to the punch. And the Model 70 really was a fast, stinking fast computer. It was great. So this particular auction is for the Model 70, which is a little taller than a pizza box style of computer, but it's that desktop, not tower, form factor. The Model 80 was the 386 tower form factor for the PS2s. This is a Model 70 386, and I'm not sure exactly what differentiates that from just a plain old Model 70. Maybe it actually means the same thing, and they just stuck the 386 on the badge just because it's a 386. They wanted to say, hey, we got one too, guys. Also, the keyboard is with this particular auction. It's that Model M style buckling spring IBM keyboard that we all love, and the computer works, which is interesting because a lot of the PS2s that I see for one reason or another on eBay are not in fully functional condition. This one claims to be. I guess the only thing that I would say would put me off a little on this auction is it's not terribly clean. It looks smudged up, and I just wonder if the seller didn't do a good enough job cleaning up the computer for taking the photos, like we were talking about before. How much work is it to put something on eBay? But I definitely would have tried to get a little bit more white out of this computer and not as many things that look like fingerprints. Could just be photographic shadows, but it kind of looks like the case is a bit smudged up. But hey, what are you going to do? I mean, it's old. But it's fun, and so that's my pick.
Yeah, I think I have some recollection of these. I believe I worked at a publishing company doing basically just typing, which is actually great because you know like a completely mindless activity. But it was done on these. I'm pretty sure unless there were other PS2s. Like I don't know how the Model 70 fits in exactly, but it looked just like this.
A little bit more powerful than the Model 50, but a similar form factor. So you might have been using a 286 machine, because it sounds like the work you were doing wouldn't necessarily need the super-duper machine gun horsepower of a Model 70. But if it was later in their life cycle, who knows?
Yeah. Another thing I remember was, I was one of, you know, whatever, it was like 50, 60, 70, you know, people doing data entry. It was, markup. And, just the noise of this room full of very fast typists on these loud keyboards was really something.
Spring. Yeah.
I mean, it was actually kind of soothing in a way, just because it was just like white noise.
And actually, you know, I'm hallucinating a little bit. I think these might have been late 80s, now that I think about it. It might not have crept into the 90s. I didn't Wikipedia this before we got into it. So it's possible that I'm still within the safe range. I'm still within the 80s.
No, I'm sure I was using a Model 70 at the end of the 80s. Just having a look at the specs that they've listed here for it, and it says a 120 gigabyte hard drive. I think that might have been 120 megabytes, but...
yes. Yeah, I don't think...
I remember one of the problems I had with my Model 70 was lack of hard drive space, and I think if I had 120 gigabytes back then, I wouldn't have been advertising to many people. Probably would have sent the company broke trying to buy that kind of thing. But no, I had a Model 70, and just running so much software on it, I had inline compression of stuff on the hard drive, had stuff being moved off to nearline storage, so every now and again it would prompt you to load a zip cartridge or a floppy disk that had a executable program on it. So I was just trying to squeeze as much onto the machine as possible, as it was my main machine in the office. But 89, early 90s, that was my main desktop machine, and I think I was forever fighting with it. Solid beast, but still, you know, I was wanting to do more with my computers than they were really capable of doing at the time.
But late 80s, so I didn't violate my principles. Thank you, Michael. I appreciate it.
Excellent. Michael, you want to do the next one?
Oh, the next one is, again, a late 80s computer, one that many of our North American and possibly European listeners wouldn't be familiar with, and that was the Microbee, a made-in-Australia computer. This one is a fairly complete set. So you've got the colour monitor, the computer, you've got the... I believe even a drive for it. So it's got a built-in 3.5-inch drive. So as far as a usable machine goes, this one's pretty good. The earlier Microbees had external storage and a lot more ribbon cables coming out for the breakouts and everything. But this one has got quite a bit of interest going down here in Oz. So currently 12 bidders going for it. I'm not one of them. But it's good to see some examples of Australian computers in good working condition coming up onto eBay. I'm sure this is a bit of a struggle between other collectors, but I've got my VZ200 and VZ300 Dick Smith computers. The Micro B was one that my wife and her father used to use, but I haven't been able to get much interest in her in reliving her retro computer days. I'll have to work harder. Yeah, we'll see how this one goes, but there's even a video of it running. So if you just want to pop over and have a look, an example of a computer that you might not have ever seen and possibly won't get your hands on if you're not down here in Australia.
Yeah, I have certainly never heard of this. Although looking at the pictures, the first thing that sort of jumped out at me is that, you know, it kind of looks like a BBC Micro, both the colors that the screen has, and you know, even a little bit the form factor, although it does appear to be a Z80 machine, so it's not, apart from that superficial look, anything related.
Yeah, I think that was pretty much the look back then. So, well, definitely here in Australia, I think they were following more the UK market as far as style and, well, sharing the same video output style. But no, it does have a passing resemblance, but on the inside, it's quite a different machine.
Okay, let's see. So, I have a couple of auctions. So, the first one that I saw here was, it is an Apple II no slot clock. And it is, basically looks like a little, chip socket, with a little chip inside of it. The way this works is that basically, if you have one of these, you can put it in, to one of the, you know, sockets somewhere for an Apple II, and then you put whatever chip you took out of the socket into the top of it. And so what this does is kind of intercepts some of the, addressing signals so that, you can talk to the clock that's on the chip inside the socket. And, you know, so it's called a no slot clock because it doesn't actually require putting a peripheral card in. I think these things are pretty cool. I kind of, you know, first of all, because it doesn't, you know, it's a fairly simple addition that doesn't really seem to take much, it doesn't take any room, but I kind of brought this up. First of all, it's not, I forget the chip number, but it's a Dallas, you know, something or other. It's a fairly standard chip, and other computers can use it. I mean, you know, I don't think it's just the fact that the software is kind of like relevant for the Apple II. But the other thing that kind of occurred to me when I looked at this is I'm not sure it's so great that it's tested, because these things have a battery inside of them that starts being used as soon as you first use it. If you see one of these, you may or may not actually want it to have been tested, because if it was tested 4 years ago, that's 4 years less that you have on the battery. This one is being listed for $15. I think you might be able to beat that. I forget what the seller was, UT Source or something. There was, you know, just a chip seller. I was able to get a few new ones. I brought this up just because it was sort of interesting. I'm not sure if you would necessarily want to buy this particular one. And I am going to steal something from Carrington. Carrington put in an auction in the notes and then didn't show up. But so he had a couple of things. But the one that I will mention is he has a link here to a vintage 1982 NASA HP 9236 9836A engineering computer. So part of what's is, you know, supposed to be interesting about this is that it's, you know, it's kind of like, it's got NASA heritage. It's being given as a buy it now of $750, and, you can make an offer, and I think that's probably too much for this. The reason that this jumped out at me is, again, you know, not so much about the niceness of this auction, but I recall, I was hunting around a little bit for, this computer for a while, because there was a video, I think it was on it might have been like on the History Channel or something that had a segment that was supposed to be at the hotel where they were, you know, unveiling the Lisa or something like that. And they used this computer as a prop, this particular, you know, HP 9000, the 9836A thing, as a prop to stand in for the Lisa. And you know, it took quite a while to find this computer, because it's it kind of looks a lot like a lot of other things, but not enough. You know, it looks a little bit like an Apple II or an Apple III, but it's not really. So anyway, if you were wondering what that computer was, this is what it is. And if you want to spend $750 for a NASA-certified one, here it is.
You know what I think is fascinating? The screen burn-in on this, if that's what it is, looks like one of those control panel, like a status indicator of some things that are going on. I mean, if you click on, and again, listeners can't see this, but I've clicked on the left-hand picture on eBay to, and then I've blown it up a little bit, and I'm looking at the screen, and there are some columns down there that look like they were status indicators for particular parameters.
Hmm. Yeah, and probably had them scrolling through. The columns seem to be quite distinctly burnt in to the screen.
Right. So that might have been some actual operational work. Who knows? Maybe this sucker was at mission control.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. I actually didn't look so closely at that picture, but yeah. So it's worth clicking on that picture just to kind of see it. It looks like something you could imagine being in mission control.
Oh, it's a very computery looking computer.
Yeah, it's not particularly distinctive, but it does it does have that computer look. okay, I think that's it on the eBay auctions, and I think that's actually we're at a point where we can talk about our sort of closing discussions. So, Earl, any closing thoughts?
Sure. Just didn't want to run off and leave people wondering where I was at. I'm taking a little bit of a break, a bit of a sabbatical from the RCR and also even perhaps from some of the retro computing activities. I've got some things going on the home front that are literally sucking up all of my time and energy. And nothing bad. Nobody worry about me. But definitely I've got some irons in the fire that I need to tend to. And once I have appropriately tended to those, then it's my intention to be back. But just wanted to let people know I might be out for a little while, and I didn't walk off in a rage quit.
Yeah, all right, that's good. That's good. Yeah, well, we'll look forward to your irons being dealt with.
Tended.
And your return. Michael, did you have any?
No, just I suppose, as I said earlier, I'm just going to have to go downstairs and start doing something about my collection. One of my problems is once I sort of grab something to go and put it on eBay, I start going into deep reminiscing and then suddenly can't part with it and put it back on the shelf and then wander back upstairs and have achieved nothing. But I'm going to have to be hard, be tough. I'm going to have to do some culling. That's it. I'm just going to have to do some culling over the Christmas break. But nothing else interesting happening here in Michael Land.
Okay. And for me, let's see. So I just earlier today, kind of finished up doing some scanning of a magazine called Soft Talk for the IBM PC. So I scanned all the covers and I scanned the first issue and the tables of contents. And it's kind of an interesting thing. Within the last couple of weeks, wound up with an entire, the full run of them. And it's a weird thing because, we've even earlier in this show, we mentioned the Soft Talk magazine, which was a very popular and very well-loved magazine for the Apple II. And in 1984, that same company briefly ran a little ST Mac magazine, which I think we mentioned before, too. I hadn't heard of that until really quite recently. And there was also an IBM PC-oriented one too that started in 1982. Another one I had not heard of at the time, but it has a lot of the same format as the Apple II one. So it's a little bit like if anyone watched the show Sliders, which was the premise was essentially that it's like you slide into an alternate universe where the history was a little bit different. It's a lot like that when you read the Soft Talk for the IBM PC because it looks like Soft Talk, but it's about the PC. Very weird.
Not the Soft Talk that you're familiar with.
But it has all the same, column names, and, Al Tomovic wrote some of the things, and, it's very strange. But so, yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to it because it's
it's familiar and yet entirely new. You know, like I won't have read any of these before. It'll take me a long time to scan them, I think, but the first one's there and all the covers are there and the table of contents has been scanned from each of them so that at least you can sort of see what's supposed to be in that issue. So that's fun.
That's very, very good work there, Paul. Looks very interesting. I agree. I'll have to go for a bit of a read. Go to the soft talk that I've never been to before.
Okay, so I guess that's all. So there's a in JuiceGS, which is the Apple II magazine that Ken Gagne, frequent contributor to RCR, publishes. He had us do a holiday gift guide. So if you want to read things we have written in an Apple II magazine, that's coming out, I think, soon. Shortly, that will be published. So anyway, so that's it for this show. Number 90 is over. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums, or Retro Computers in the forums at vintage-computer.com/VC forum. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast, or you can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And if you have a chance, write a review on iTunes, please. That will help other people find the show. And so, with that, until next time,
Retro Compute.
Away.